And I will call this meeting to order on February 21st. This is the Ag Finance and Policy Committee. This meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. A roll call, Mr. Smith, please.
Chair Sundin.
Here.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson present.
Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R here.
Representative Hansen J.
Hansen J present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick.
Lewick present.
Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson present.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have the minutes of the February 16th meeting. Representative Thompson, will you move those minutes?
I move the minutes, Chair. So move.
Okay. Any questions or corrections on the minutes of the February 16th meeting? Seeing none, hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Thank you. The minutes are adopted. We have four bills on the agenda. Three will be moved on to other committees, and Representative Anderson's will be laid over for possible inclusion. We have to adjust our agenda as originally posted. Vice Chair Vang has two bills up in different committees, so we're bumping her up on the agenda. Apologies, Representative Listelgard. Thanks for your flexibility, not that you had a choice. House File 2996, Vice Chair Vang has industrial hemp extract food additives authorized. Vice Chair Vang, you have 2996 on industrial hemp and extract food additives. We have about 20 minutes blocked for this bill, although the bill does have a fiscal impact. The fiscal note indicated on an impact on the Office of Administrative Hearings, so it will need to also make a stop in state government finance. We ask that they return the bill after they've heard it. Vice Chair Vang, please move your bill and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2996 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Once again, thanks, Mr. Chair, members. This bill seeks to assist Minnesota's hemp industry by designating industrial hemp extract as an approved food additive, subject to regulation by state and local law. This legislation is an effort to provide Minnesota hemp producers and businesses some needed regulatory certainty regarding hemp-derived food and beverage products, including those with CBD. It would also provide consumers with confidence that a made-in-Minnesota hemp product meets high regulatory standards, removing confusion in the marketplace and creating a level playing field for Minnesota-produced hemp products and related businesses. The bill instructs the Department of Ag to develop rules to regulate the production of hemp extract and food containing hemp extract. This legislation is similar in scope and purpose to a 2020 enactment in the state of Virginia. Several states have enacted their own intrastate regulatory mechanism permitting hemp extracts in food and beverage applications, such as Florida, Virginia, New York, and California. Most recently, Pennsylvania has taken this regulatory path to promote their in-state hemp businesses and products to much success. Minnesota can also do the same. I also want to note letters of support from the Minnesota Industrial Hemp Association, Sensible Minnesota, that is a nonprofit that focuses on consumer safety, the Minnesota Hemp Business Coalition, and various stakeholders representing the hemp industry. Members, thank you for your time and for your flexibility. I also have two testifiers who will speak about their experiences in the hemp industry and this legislation.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Is there John Dugas from Superior Molecular, please?
Present.
Can you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yep. My name is John Dugas, and I am the founder of Superior Molecular. Good afternoon, chairman and committee members. So my name is John Dugas, and I founded Superior Molecular, which was a licensed industrial hemp processor and extraction lab in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. I'm here today to lend my support for HF 2996 to authorize hemp extract for limited use in food and beverage applications as determined by the MDA through the rulemaking process. 4 years ago, I became inspired by stories concerning the lack of quality processing and outlets for growers in the industrial hemp industry of Minnesota. This inspired me to start a business that became Superior Molecular, which creates superior molecules for the industrial hemp industry. At this time, the Department of Agriculture stressed there was an essential need for businesses like mine that could bring value-added products to the industry and provide an outlet for farmers. Over 2 years ago, we were approached by several large beverage companies asking about the efficacy of emulsifying cannabidiol or CBD hemp extract for the purpose of creating craft beverages. Not only did we find it was possible, it became a core foundation for our business. We have observed massive shifts in the craft beverage industry on the national and local level, and our value-added product was poised to accommodate that shift. What has become clear over the past 8 months is that while the product ingredient we produced was compliant with applicable Minnesota agricultural rules in the 2018 Farm Bill, our beverage customers and partners could not use this product to manufacture a beverage or food item within the state of Minnesota. Subsequently, our customers received cease and desist letters or other letters of dissent from the Department of Agriculture. They were forced to cease production, and their products were subsequently removed from the shelves, and all projects were paused. Our customers complied with state orders only to discover that their version of a hemp extract beverage had been replaced by one from an out-of-state manufacturer, which to our knowledge is available today on shelves at various big-name grocery stores across Minnesota, receiving little to no enforcement action. It is our belief that if anybody should have the privilege of exploring non-alcoholic infused beverages, it would be our tightly inspected and regulated craft beverage industry. I cannot stress enough the severity of the damage incurred to our struggling hemp economy due to these actions. Like any other agricultural crop, it all begins with the farmer, and it's simple. If we can't sell our value-added product, we can't buy hemp crops from many of the wonderful local small-town family-run hemp cultivation operations. If the state intends on ceding this economic activity to companies outside of our borders and destroying the revenue channel for Minnesota's hemp businesses, then it will surely keep moving in the current direction, maintaining the status quo. However, if the state's intentions are for the Minnesotans to benefit from the cultivation, production, and value-added nature of its hemp businesses, then I implore you to seek reason surrounding CBD and its regulation. HF 2996 is a step in the right direction to develop meaningful and reasonable regulations, which in turn will build consumer confidence in the safety and legitimacy of these products. The Minnesota hemp industry is at a regulatory crossroads. Markets greatly matter, and I ask for your support for this policy to change and provide clarity for Minnesota hemp businesses and consumers alike. The practical effect of current law surrounding CBD in Minnesota and Minnesota hemp businesses must stand on the sidelines while businesses in other states reap the rewards at our expense. Thank you so much to Representative Vang for your courage to tackle such an important issue for our industry. We greatly appreciate the hard work you're doing, and we are committed to working with legislators and other interested parties and the department to rectify the situation moving forward. I encourage the committee to look favorably upon this legislation in order to assist our industrial hemp industry in Minnesota. We need your help. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Dukas. Next up, we have Bleacher Vial on the court. That's as close as I'm going to get. Please pronounce your name correctly for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, sorry to interrupt. He is not on the call.
Okay. Well, I understand this bill is going to be returned to us after it goes to government ops. So any questions to the author or the sole testifier? Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that I pushed the right button. Can you hear?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. To the author, I think there's a lot of good points to this bill. I just want to clarify a couple of things. Your bill on line 118 and 117 is specific to mention state and local law. And yet a lot of foods, or most foods in this country, are regulated by the FDA on the federal level. So how do you totally basically skip FDA when we're talking about food additives when you want to make this bill law here in Minnesota?
Chair Vang, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. That is an excellent question. Many of our stakeholders would definitely love more clarity from the FDA, but the reality is they've been silent on regulation of this portion of the hemp industry. We know that consumer demand is not changing, it is increasing, and we need a regulatory body, and FDA has not been there to develop regulations. And so, it's up to us at the state to look at those regulations.
Chair Anderson, or Representative Anderson, anything further?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Just another follow-up. You specifically mentioned intrastate commerce when you mentioned the bill, and yet your testifier talked about interstate commerce. It's puzzling how other states can come across our borders and I don't mean to say dump, but sell their products in Minnesota when we can't even have our own processors sell products here. Why has that been happening, and to what extent?
Chair Vang, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I can have my testifier elaborate this if they're able to answer this question. Representative Anderson, I'm open up to amending the language to give more clarity on this issue. Interstate commerce is not my field of expertise. So if you have any amendments or language that you think that will be helpful to providing clarity, I'm open to that.
No, I'm just concerned about why other states can come into our state and sell their products in the past. It doesn't seem fair, and I totally agree with your testifier, Mr. Dugas, that doesn't seem right.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And this is why this bill is there, to make sure that we can provide that regulation and that we're not the ones who are stopping our Minnesota-owned hemp industry from thriving in the state.
Thank you. We also have department professionals on tap here. If they want to weigh in on this, now would be the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you see me okay?
Yes, Andrea Valvo, please.
Yes, thank you so much. For the record, my name is Andrea Valvo, Service Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you so much. Just to answer the question Representative Anderson brought up, it is illegal to sell, so it doesn't matter where the product comes from. It's the product that we care about. So we would love the resources to be able to go after all of the products that come through that are illegal, but we do not have the resources to do so. So I just want to clarify that we're not going after Minnesota businesses specifically. It's the products that we go after, whether it's from the state or another state.
Thank you. Anything further, Representative Anderson? You're on mute again.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's a little surprising that it is illegal for other states, other companies from out of state to come in here and sell our products. So I think there needs to be some clarifications made. And yeah, I think this bill is a good start on Minnesota companies and products, but maybe additional enforcement of out-of-state companies would be in order, because we certainly would want to favor our in-state companies as well in this. So that's what I have to say. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Vang, I guess that wraps up the questions for right now. Would you like to renew your motion?
I move, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Vang. Chair Vang renews her motion that House File 2996 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Excuse Representative me. Thompson has his hand up.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, I did not see that. Representative Thompson, please.
I was just curious what Minnesota companies offer this product, and if there are any African-American companies that would benefit from this product. And so I was just curious if there was something that Representative Vang knew about.
Chair Vang, any comments on that?
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Thompson for your question. I think there are companies that are from BIPOC communities, and speaking from my own community, I know that from the farming producers to those interested in, you know, hemp is an indigenous plant to the Hmong community, and that is something that we have used back in the old land. And so, you know, hemp is beneficial to all communities, regardless, and it's have a long standing history in you know, BIPOC communities too, I believe.
And Chair Thompson?
Chair, with all due respect, the B in BIPOC always missed the mark. And so, again, I asked about African American organizations, because the African American organizations, I don't know many of them, but when we talk, when we put people in this group, BIPOC, right, the B is always marked in BIPOC. We don't get our fair share of funds that come out of the state. And so that's why I specifically asked about African-American organizations.
Okay, quite possibly we could have more detailed information forwarded to you, Representative Thompson, or possibly Chair Vang would be able to give a more detailed answer on that when we hear this bill again.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Any further questions for the author or the testifier? Okay, that motion has been renewed. The motion is before us. Mr. Smith, please take the roll.
Chair Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Vice Chair Vang.
Aye.
Vang votes aye. Representative Anderson.
Anderson votes aye.
Anderson votes aye. Representative Burkle.
Burkle votes aye.
Burkle votes aye. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R. Aye.
Hansen R. Aye. Representative Hansen J.
Hansen J. Aye.
Hansen J. votes aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn aye.
Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Lippert.
Lippert aye.
Lippert votes aye. Representative Lewick.
Lewick votes aye.
Lewick votes aye. Representative Miller.
Miller aye.
Miller votes aye. Representative Nelson.
Nelson aye.
Nelson votes aye. Representative Thompson.
Thompson aye.
13 ayes and 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Okay, there will be 13 ayes and 0 nays. The motion prevails in House File 2996 is on its way to state government finance. Next up, we have Representative Lislegard with House File 3104, which deals with the County Agricultural Society sales tax exemption to be expanded to include sales prior to the county fair and County Agricultural Society tax saving transfer to fairground owner requirement removed. About 15 minutes block for this bill. This bill comes from the tax committee, but they requested that it be returned to them. There's no fiscal impact on the ag budget. I will move the bill to get it before the committee. So I move House File 3104 to be recommended to the and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Lissegard, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about this bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And you're right, Chair Sundin, I did not have a choice when the bill is going to be heard. But House File 3104 is for the County Ag Society sales tax exemption to be expanded to include sales prior to the county fair. But, you know, like you said, the bill also removes a requirement for the County Ag Society's tax savings to be transferred to the fairground. And I have with me AJ, who can discuss the bill in further detail.
Hey, AJ Durr, would you please identify yourself for the record and offer your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Durr, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. And thank you to Representative Lislegard for bringing this bill forward today. House File 3104, as Representative Lislegard said, makes a couple of small improvements to the sales tax exemption for sales made by county ag societies that was passed in Representative Mark Court's 2019 tax bill. Before I get into that, I first want to update the committee that every county ag society that I've talked to, whether it's visiting them at their fair or talking to them at our annual meeting in January, has said that this sales tax exemption has been working very well, and it has allowed each and every one of them to make significant investments and improvements into their fairgrounds. But while talking to all those county ag societies, a couple of issues kept popping up that hoping to address in this bill today. Section one of the bill is, as Representative Lislegard says, it allows the county ag society to hold on to the savings of the sales tax exemption regardless of who owns the fairgrounds. Roughly half of the fairgrounds in the state of Minnesota are owned by the county ag society, so this wouldn't affect them. And the other half are owned by a local unit of government, whether it be a county or a municipality. Most often the county, but there are a couple municipalities out there. And this doesn't really so much fix a problem, as county ag societies get along really well with their counties and municipalities, but it helps create an efficiency. As what I keep hearing back from county ag societies is, do we have to send them the savings just so they send it back to us? Because it's really the county ag society is the entity that that maintains and improves the fairgrounds. Section two of the bill addresses an oversight on our part when we did the previous sales tax exemption on my part. And what the legislature was intending in 2019 was to limit that sales tax exemption to sales made for the purpose of holding the county fair. Because county ag societies do make, I should say, a lot of county ag societies do make sales outside of the fair, typically for renting out space for other events or for renting out some storage space. And those sales under this bill would still be subject to the sales tax. But what this changes is some county ag societies do sell tickets, whether it's admission to the fair or admission to a lot of grandstand events prior to the days of the fair. So this would allow those to still be exempt from the sales tax, but it must be for an event, whether it's an admission to the fair or the event has to take place during the fair and on the fairgrounds. So we believe that it still holds to the legislative intent back in 2019. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my testimony and stand for questions. And I also have Ms. Tiffany Gustin with me to help answer any questions that members might have. Thank you.
Does Tiffany Gustin, have testimony to offer?
No, it's just here to answer questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Then questions for the testifier and the author from the committee, please. Representative Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a question for Ms. Gustin. AJ had mentioned that there's a variety of ownerships. As I remember right, I believe Aiken County owns the fairgrounds in our backyard. Could you confirm that, Tiffany?
Yes, Representative Lewick. And
Ms. Gustin.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. Representative Lewick does represent my home county here in Aiken, and he is correct. Our fairgrounds is owned by the county, however, is operated by the County Ag Society.
Thank you. Anything else?
Just to follow, you know, that's a, you know, a real life example of the, you know, how complicated it gets. Because, yeah, the county board has always been very protective of the ag society. And so at best, if money comes in and it gets transferred back, that we need to see if we can just clean that whole thing up. It's a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lloyd. Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question for Mr. Dewar. AJ, when you mentioned selling tickets for advance tickets for grandstands, things like that, just want to clarify, I know this is for county fairs, but I couldn't help but thinking about the state fair. And my favorite band is that Brown Band is coming this year to the fair and advance tickets. This wouldn't affect at all pricing and sales tax on the state fair. Is that a totally different animal?
To the author? Representative Lissard?
I think that was for
Mr. Durer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. You're correct that this bill would not affect any sales made at the state fair.
Okay, Representative Nelson, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is probably for Andrew. Question on, I know there's several county fairs that in the off season will lease out some of the buildings for storage. Is that subject to sales tax? Because I know it's applied differently across the state depending on how the county sees it.
Mr. Durer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson. Yes, those sales would still be subject to the sales tax. What the original sales tax that was passed in 2019 and under this bill, it would be for events that take place during the fair and on the fairgrounds. But this would allow prior sales, but the event still has to take place during the fair and on the fairgrounds.
Okay. Any further, Representative Nelson?
No, nothing further. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That's great. So any other questions, comments? Okay. Seeing no further hands or hearing any other voices, thank you, Mr. Durer and Ms. Gustine. Representative Listegard, any closing comments before I renew my motion?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for hearing this. I think it's a good bill. And also, I just want on record that my dear friend Chair Sundin is not only the right guy for ag as he grows his own stuff, he's also the best cook in the house. So I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you. I just might vote for this bill. Thanks, Representative Sigard. I'm going to renew that motion that 3104 be recommended and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Mr. Smith, would you please take the roll?
Chair Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Vice Chair Vang. Representative Anderson.
Anderson votes aye.
Anderson votes aye. Representative Burkle.
Aye.
Burkle votes aye. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R. Aye.
Hansen R. votes aye. Representative Hansen J. Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert votes aye. Representative Lewick.
Lewick votes aye.
Representative Lewick votes aye. Representative Miller.
Miller, aye.
Miller votes aye. Representative Nelson.
Nelson votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Representative Thompson. Representative Vang.
Nelson, aye.
Thompson votes aye. And Representative Hansen J. We have 11 ayes and zero nays, Mr. Chair.
Okay, there being 11 ayes and zero nays, that motion prevails, and House File 3104 is on its way back to the Tax Committee. Representative Cleavorn, you are up next with House File 3217, a bill protecting individuals' mental health data. Take it away, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I would like to move House File 3217 to be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Okay. I understand there's an amendment. Would you like to offer that amendment first and put it in a shape that you would prefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move the A1 amendment. And what the bill is about privacy and what's public and non-public. And the amendment would also include pass-through entities that might be able, that might come into contact with the information. And they would also be required to keep the information as private. So I would ask that the bill be put in the order the author desires.
Okay, we heard the A1 amendment. Are there any questions to the author on that? Okay, seeing no questions. All those in favor of the A1 signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Okay, that motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Cleavorn, Representative Anderson also has an amendment. What's your preference? Would you like to present your bill first or take care of this amendment now?
No, I think we can address the A2 at this time, and I would like to thank Representative Anderson for bringing it forward. Representative Anderson, do you want to speak to the A2?
Representative Anderson, do you want to move that A2 amendment?
I'll move the A2, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Questions on the A2? Proceed. Any questions?
And what does it do?
Yeah, I was going to address that. Thank you. Just for the record, the A2 would add an effective date immediately following enactment. I think it's a very good amendment, and I'm thankful to my colleague for closing this gap for my bill. So thank you, Representative Anderson. I would encourage a yes vote.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, all those in favor of the 8-2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Cleburne, please proceed. Let's hear from your witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to give a little bit of brief background on what this bill does. Currently, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture funds services to support farmers in stress, such as the Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline, and farmer mental health counseling by mental health practitioners. Mental health is still an extremely sensitive topic and loaded with stigma. To encourage farmers to seek help for mental and behavioral health concerns, it's important to be able to assure them their privacy will be protected. Although it has never happened, the Department of Agriculture wants to explicitly protect user identity as non-public in case they or a third-party contractor should receive a public information request for this information. This bill would modify the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act to prevent public access information collected and maintained by the Department of Agriculture and the state college and university system when that information identifies an individual who is connected to farming or agriculture that, and it's an important and, sought assistance with a mental or behavioral health issue or contacted the Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline. This bill would allow the agencies to release private or non-public information in an emergency if it would be necessary to protect the health or safety of any person. And to this, I would ask that we move to the testifiers.
Okay, I see first up would be Meg Monahan with the department senior. She's a senior advisor at the department. Meg Monahan, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. For the record, my name is Meg Moynihan. I serve as a senior advisor on strategy and innovation at the Department of Agriculture. And I wish you good morning, and I thank Representative Cleburne for carrying this bill and also for inviting me to testify. I really enjoy coming before your committee, and I'm glad to be back. I have served at the department for 20 years, and since 2017, my focus has really been largely on developing efforts and initiatives that will support farmers and others in agriculture and agricultural communities who are experiencing stress. And that includes mental and behavioral health challenges. And I think Representative Cleburne did a very comprehensive job of introducing this bill. I want to assure you that while at the department, we try not to collect sensitive information regarding any of these calls or services, but sometimes that information is handed to us and then we have it. Our intention is to treat that information confidentially, but we want to explicitly be able to protect those users' identities as non-public, just in case we ever get a data request. Well-meaning graduate student says, I'd like to the names of all the students that called the helpline because I want to do a study. We want to really be able to promise people who use these services that we are protecting this very information that's very precious and sometimes very sensitive to them. My colleague, Chris McNulty, who is Deputy General Counsel, is here with me today, as is Deputy Commissioner Vauble, whom you've heard from before. And Mr. McNulty, we think of him as our data privacy guru, or data practices guru, I should say, at the department. So he's well able to answer any technical questions you have, and Deputy Commissioner Vauble could answer policy questions, and I can answer implementation questions. So I thank you again, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, let's open it up for questions to the author and testifiers and the professionals from the department. Representative Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, since Ms. Moynihan raised the issue of research. It ties into that, and it relates to how, by classifying this as non-public, would there be the ability to evaluate the program as to its efficacy? So would this prevent, I know it may be, you know, the comment about it being a graduate student wanting to search, but what if there was an actual legislative request to, for example, a legislative auditor to see how many people actually are served by this program, or what was their satisfaction with the program, or was the program effective? And so I'm a little concerned about completely blocking this off, if this would prevent any evaluation of program effectiveness, which is really comes back to Minnesotans. And then I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Meg Monahan, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I think this is a question best answered by Mr. McNulty, who can talk to the subtleties of that question.
You froze up on that. Who are you referring to?
Mr. McNulty, sir.
Chris McNulty, can you identify yourself and help us out?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair. My name is Chris McNulty. I am Deputy General Counsel for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. To the question, the bill protects the identity of callers who are seeking assistance in our mental health programs, and it also protects the identity of the business potentially they work for, and that's why the word person appears in there. What it would not do, however, is protect general information that does not specifically identify a caller or someone who is calling on behalf of a caller. So statistical information regarding the program, such as funding, such as numbers of calls, those types of items would not be protected in this bill. This bill simply protects the identity of callers or people calling on behalf of a third party about whom they are concerned.
Thank you. Chair Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then it would prevent someone contacting the caller. They'd have to be, let's say they're a medical professional. I see the exemption there, but let's say there was a medical professional that called as to evaluation of the service provided. It sounds to me that that would be prohibited under the screen.
Mr. McNulty?
Currently, that would be correct. The department and any pass-through grantees would not be allowed to confirm or deny the identity of anyone who called to use the service. That being said, if a medical health professional contacted us, there is always the possibility of trying to get the informed consent of the person who called. But we would not be able to divulge the information directly to that provider, minus that or, for instance, a court order.
Chair Hansen?
My final follow-up, Mr. Chair. And, you know, this program has been around for quite a while, and it continues to be referred to in different ways. Today I've heard it referred to as only for farmers or farm-related or agriculture, when in the past I've heard it referred to as farmers and rural. And I think it's really important that services are provided for mental health, not just to one profession. You know, Ms. Moynihan, I think 3 or 4 years ago, I raised the issue with public safety professionals or teachers. Mental health is a real crisis for a number of people. And that if we're going to do a program only for one profession in this state, we need to see if it's actually working and who is being served. And I understand about privacy, and it's very difficult, but we also have to make sure that we're providing effective service to people throughout the state, and often the best way to do an evaluation is a third-party evaluation.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay, Representative Cleaver, do you have any closing comments on your bill?
Thank you, Chair Sundin. And I think that Representative Hansen brought up one major issue that I wanted to address in closing, and that is mental health is a crisis in many sectors in our state. And while this addresses the farm and rural stress in Minnesota and the individuals who live in the communities, I do encourage us to think about mental health broadly all across our state and all across careers. And families have a variety of issues. So I thank Representative Hansen for raising that issue as well. With that, Chair Sundin, I renew my motion for House File 3217 as amended. You recommended to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Civil Law. Thank you.
Okay, that is the motion before us. Mr. Smith, please take the roll.
Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Representative Vang. Representative Anderson.
Anderson votes aye.
Anderson votes aye. Representative Burkle.
Burkle votes aye.
Burkle votes aye. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R, aye.
Hansen R votes aye. Representative Hansen J. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn votes aye.
Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert votes aye. Representative Lewick.
Lewick votes aye.
Lewick votes aye. Representative Miller.
Miller, aye.
Miller votes aye. Representative Nelson.
Nelson votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Representative Thompson.
Thompson votes aye.
Thompson votes aye. 11 ayes and 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. 11 ayes and 0 nays. There be the. Okay, let me start again here. There being 11 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 3217, as amended, is on its way to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Representative Anderson, you have House File 2969 dealing with the grain buyer license requirements. Would you like to move your bill and explain?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 2969. And I also have an amendment, Mr. Chair. If I could offer a brief explanation first before I offer the amendment.
Please do, yeah.
Okay, thank you. This bill deals with the dollar amounts, the annual gross sales levels at which grain elevators and the feed mills are subject to certain auditing requirements here in the state of Minnesota. And these numbers were last set back in 2019 when the price of corn was probably around $3 a bushel, the price of soybeans around $8 a bushel. And the price of oats was a couple dollars a bushel, would be my recollection. And now today, those prices have doubled and in some cases tripled. So I think it warrants looking at these levels and modifying them somewhat to reflect what's happened with the price of grains that these elevators and feed mills deal with. And Mr. Chairman, the A1 amendment deals with, there's two sets of numbers here that this bill deals with the amendment. And the amendment, the A1 amendment, deals with kind of the medium-sized elevators. Back in 2019, the level at which they were subject to an audit, a grain audit, was $5 million. And we'd like to raise that figure to $7.5 million. And that would be the amendment that would go on to the original bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions on the A1 for the author? Okay. Hearing none, seeing none. All those in favor of the A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Okay, that motion prevails and that amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, please proceed. Let's hear from your witnesses on the bill as amended.
I have a couple of witnesses, and also the Department of Ag is standing by, and Nick Milanowski from that division is here to answer questions as well. But just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. I was doing some figuring in my head based on current prices of grain. And if a facility, a grain elevator, a feed mill, had 4 loads of soybeans hauled in, semi-loads I'm talking now, 5 loads of corn, and 1 load of oats, at today's market prices, that would be over $100,000 right there. So you can see for, in this case, 10 loads of grain coming in, would put them over that lower end schedule. So we would like to see that increased modestly up to $250,000. And I have a couple of witnesses, Mr. Chair, and we'd like to hear from them at this time, please.
I see that Mr. Greg Reese, please. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Mr. Reese.
Okay, can you hear me?
Gotcha.
Okay, super. My name is Greg Reese, and I'm with the Vermilion Elevator, Incorporated, Vermilion, Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for allowing me to speak today. We are an independent country grain elevator located in Dakota County. I am third generation in a business that has spanned over 74 years. Our location is 20 to 25 miles from the river terminals and 12 miles from a unit grain train terminal. We serve farmers, hobby farmers, homeowners, and vegetable growers in Dakota County and beyond. In regards to the first part of raising the exemption of $100,000 to $250,000, this doesn't necessarily pertain to me, but as you know, for grain buyers paying with cash, certified check, cashiers, bank money orders, if the grain buyer is following protocol, I see no problem with this. It shouldn't be an issue. In regards to the $5 million threshold, here's a little background. In 2021, our grain purchases were 836,000 bushels. It amounted to $4,950,000 in gross dollars. In 2021, I participated in an advisory group meeting, and at that time, it was stated that there's approximately 20 to 25 grain buyers that are sitting at this threshold. I don't think that number has changed too much. With, as Representative Anderson has stated, with the current commodity prices, I and the others, many others, will most likely go over this $5 million threshold. A full audit costs approximately $10,000 and can exceed $15,000. And if we look at this, you're looking at, for that alone, that's 200 grand of additional costs for us as grain dealers. And it may be a few years before prices drop. So this isn't just a one-time situation. It could go on year after year. In the past, we were required, prior to 2019, we were required to have a review by a CPA, and I felt that was adequate. It met the requirements for the USDA, and it gave us the information we needed, and at that time it met your needs. On a personal note, spending $10,000 or more to have an outside company come in and tell me what I already know, that there may be, that there's 100,000 bushels in this corn tank and so forth, counting our bags and measuring our bushels is frustrating. I realize there's more to this, that the transparency and so forth. Going back to the Porter and Ashby losses initiated that initiated these changes back in 2020, you know, it's obvious it's critical that we protect the farmer. How do we create a level playing field? And is it through regulation, or is now the time to possibly consider, I'm sidetracking, I apologize, an indemnity fund? Farmers need to know who they're dealing with. Education is critical. They need to understand the bonding laws and so forth. I believe they would be shocked at how little coverage they have when there is a failure. And the thing is that the laws that were made by requiring the $5 million threshold, requiring the audits, I doubt that would have stopped Ashby from happening. and now we're dealing with pipeline foods. So backing up, this is a two-part, I believe it's a two-part process. Short term, I'm asking, can you raise, follow Representative Anderson's suggestion, raise the $5 million threshold to help lower our costs as small businesses in Minnesota and level the playing field. Our volume has not changed, but with $15 beans and $6.50 corn, the dollar amount is pushing us over the $5 million threshold. And then by putting us at a disadvantage with our competitors, and more so our larger competitors. And then long-term, don't rush into it, but please consider an indemnity fund. And I understand that's a separate issue. Thank you. Thank you so much for this ability to speak. And this concludes my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Next up, we have Laura Lemke, Executive Director of Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Laura Lemke, please.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Lemke. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We're a 115-year-old organization that represents the interests of the grain elevator and feed mill industry in Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2969. When the grain buyer statute was changed a couple years ago, we anticipated that there would likely be modifications needed down the road, and it seems like that time is now. With the current state of grain prices, corn being over $6 a bushel and soybeans over $16, grain buyers purchasing grain at pre-2021 prices are now dealing with some added expenses to be a grain buyer in Minnesota. That very small grain buyer who was at the $100,000 level would now be required to obtain a grain bond or an irrevocable letter of credit and submit a financial review to the state, which costs on the average anywhere between $5,000 and $10,000 or more, depending on the size and complexity of the client. Not only have these smaller operators expressed concern about the financial burden these requirements place solely on them, but some have also had a difficult time finding a CPA firm who is knowledgeable about the grain business and can perform a CPA review. In regards to the small and medium-sized grain elevators, they currently have an annual grain purchase threshold of $5 million. Prior to and just after the law change, grain elevators that were flirting with that $5 million line were saying they'd simply stop buying grain when they approached that threshold. That's no way to operate an elevator, as it stifles business growth and harms the local elevator's ability to properly service its farmer customers. Other facilities frustrated by the increasing regulations express that they'd rather quit the business than put up with more regulations and the added expenses that they would incur. A year ago, the Department of Agriculture estimated that the split between facilities over and under the $5 million threshold was about 50%. With today's grain prices, that split is closer to two-thirds or three-quarters of facilities being over that $5 million line. The MGFA feels an increase in the threshold from $5 million to $7.5 million would help alleviate some of the pressure on these smaller elevators and perhaps move us back to that 50-50 split for facilities. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Laura Lemke. Any questions for the testifiers or the author from the committee? Representative Nelson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think probably as much as anything, it's a comment. There's some unintended consequences that have happened out of this with requiring a review. I've got a small feed mill in my area that they've been put in, you know, now with the expanded limits or the lowered limits, they've had to get a review on their business, and they had to change their CPA that they've used for 27 years. And now they're no longer able to use a local one, but they're having to go outside. It's been an additional cost. And, you know, in this time of a pandemic, trying to find a CPA that can completely take over everything of their business, trying to learn all of that, to be able to share the financial information that has been able to do that, it's been a challenge for them. And, you know, the cost is just one more kind of nail in the coffin for the small Main Street businesses that are happening in our communities. And what's likely to happen is that this mill may have to close, and it'll be a larger firm from maybe a somewhat regional that's going to take over this. And so it's hurting small businesses to do this because of the additional requirements on it. I mean, we want to have checks and balances. However, this is putting undue burden on our local businesses, our Main Street that we asked for them to donate to our schools and our fundraisers, and, you know, they're going to be going away. And I think another thing that the individual that I visited with brought up that, you know, much of the requirements that, you know, they're responsible to report to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, but that's all based on tonnage of feed. And, you know, and so when you have tonnage versus a dollar amount, that, you know, the markets can swing quite rapidly or volatile. And, you know, the tons that they deal with year in and year out really don't change that much. And I don't know if somebody from the Department of Agriculture would be able to comment on what the requirements are for a small feed mill that has to report the tonnage versus the dollar amount of feed. I mean, it's a cash grain buyer that buys this grain and then manufactures it into feed that's sold right back into the local community. So I don't know if there's somebody from the department that could give some clarity there.
From the department, any response?
Mr. Chair and
Mr. Milonowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson. Right now, the requirement is that those facilities that purchase over $5 million receive a audited financial, and those that purchase less than $5 million receive a reviewed financial. There's nothing that applies to tonnage. We do require that these facilities report the amount of grain that they are storing on behalf of others on a monthly basis. That's part of our setting our bond limits, but there's nothing related to the financial reporting associated with tonnage.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, follow up?
No, thank you on that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cleburne, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is a really important conversation for us to be having. You know, after the Ashby Cooperative debacle, it gave me pause, right, to say this was a trusted member of the community who violated in a wholesale way the trust of the community. And two comments were made today that kind of give me a little bit of pause. One of the comments that was made was about the fact that there's very little coverage for anyone who would lose under this lack of financial scrutiny. So my question is, what would we say to that person if a fraud were to be perpetrated? I don't know who would want to answer that question.
Mr. Milonowski, you want to tackle that?
Absolutely, I can. I just want to repeat the question for clarification. The question is how we would respond if fraud were if a facility was accused of fraud or
yeah.
Okay.
And there were losses that were incurred.
Yeah. So the thank you, Representative Cleburne. The process right now for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is to pursue recovery through the bond claim process, and we're doing that with Pipeline Foods as we speak, and it's what we did with Ashby and other failures over the last several years. And what that involves is putting out a public statement that says that there were losses and failure to pay by the elevator to any patrons that sold grain or had grain deposited there in storage, and then open up a window for them to file claims against that bond.
A follow-up, Representative Cleburne?
Yes, thank you, Chair Sundin. So my question then is, we're really just shifting the responsibility from the buyer to the bondholder. Is that correct? Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Milowski.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cleghorn. So in the case of the bond, when a company has a bond on file, the bonding company, otherwise known as a surety, they can pursue the grain buyer or the licensed entity following that bond claim for recovery. But ultimately, yes, that money that is held there in a bond, that is made available to people who are impacted by non-payment or failure to redeliver grain.
Representative Cleburne?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the piece I'm trying to get to here is there's no such thing as free money anywhere, right? So it's the question of who's benefiting from the higher cap and who's paying the cost for the higher cap. I think that's what I'm trying to get at. So if we say we're going to raise the cap, and you know, I do believe that most of our entities are good actors, so I'm not trying to throw shade on anyone here. I'm just trying to figure out who's going to pay the cost because we as the legislature are raising the cap. So the people who are issuing the bond, they don't get that bond for free, that money behind that bond for free, right? So they would be carrying the cost. Is that what I'm hearing? If there were to be a loss.
Mr. Milanowski, further help?
Thank you, Chair and Representative Cleghorn. Yes, what you would see is that the sureties would issue payment to those people that are impacted. That is only in the event of a failure, which most recently has been insolvencies, so complete failures of facilities.
What I'm saying, what I'm trying to say, and maybe I'm not being
clear. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Sundin. What I'm trying to say is the surety is also a business and a company, right? So my question is, if we're concerned about how many CPAs currently exist who can do this extra work, that's one type of business that we're concerned about keeping in business as I'm hearing the conversation. The second company is the surety company, the bonding company. How many of those are there, and how do they feel about being held with the bag of if there were a potential loss? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Milowski, can you help us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for the confusion, Representative Cleghorn. So I'm not exactly sure how many sureties exist. We have several on file that hold bonds or that issue bonds to license holders here in Minnesota. The best way to describe these bonds, and I understand it is not a one-to-one analogy, but it is like insurance. And so
I understand the bonding process. You don't need to go down that path.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Milowski, you want to finish up there?
Sure. What these facilities would do, or what these sureties would do, is would assess the risk based on financial review in some cases, and in some cases looking at other components of the business, and assess the risk to the facility. So if the surety determines that they may have a greater risk for failure or to pay their patrons, they may charge them a higher than normal premium. So these bonds cost and have an annual cost associated with them. And based on the risk that the surety is determined, they will adjust that premium to the facility that's being licensed and issued the bond.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll let it go. Have a good day.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Okay. Hearing none, any further comments, Representative Anderson, before we lay this over?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment briefly on what the representative was wondering about. And I think it could be summed up by saying we're trying to strike a balance here that's practical and realistic. I mean, yes, there's a risk whenever anybody sells anything until they get payment, until they get that check in their hands. You could be selling an apple pie. So until you get paid, there's a risk. We're trying to be practical and realistic. And to her point too, I don't think the bonds are established to cover farmers in this case 100%. That never seems to be the case. But again, we're trying to be realistic here. Is when the value of these goods goes up, it just takes fewer number of bushels or whatever pounds to reach these thresholds. And when an elevator is working on a margin of, say, 10 cents a bushel, it doesn't take many bushels to get to that threshold. So, again, trying to strike a balance between some safety and practicality. And maybe, you know, we should be looking at an indemnity fund if we want to make sure there's no risk at all for a farmer when he sells, you know, a bushel of corn. That may be the way to go. But until we do that, I think we need to be practical and try to offer these elevators some relief from a regulation that, because of the increased prices of the commodities they deal with, it's becoming a little bit onerous for them, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Anderson, and thanks to the testifiers. House File 2969, as amended, is laid over. That concludes our business for the day. We are adjourned.